Welcome to Stepping Out of Babylon, produced by Sue Supriano. Babylon is everywhere. It's the isms and schisms not only within the system, but within ourselves. Let's unify, stand aligned, and step out of Babylon.
Hi, everybody. My name's Sue Supriano, and today I'm speaking with Dr. Peter Dale Scott. And Dr. Peter Dale Scott has been an English professor at the University of California in Berkeley, where we're speaking. He's retired now. He's a poet. But we're not going to be talking about those things. We're going to talk about the drug war, because he's written a book, co-written with Jonathan Marshall, a book called Cocaine Politics: Drugs, Armies, and the CIA in Central America. He's also written Deep Politics and the Death of JFK. So I want to ask you first off, Peter Dale Scott, what made you write, being an English professor, what brought you to writing these books about the drug war?
Well, originally I was a political science professor. I have a PhD in political science. And because I didn't approved too much of what I was supposed to teach in political science, I left that. I was a Canadian diplomat for 4 years, and very much at the edge of what I was responsible for was the question of Indochina, as we called it then. So that when I left that job in 61 and came to the University of California, I was already very concerned that America should not get involved in Vietnam, should not repeat the tragic mistakes that the French made in the 1950s in Indochina, which were disastrous for the people in Vietnam, but also disastrous for the French. So from very early on, I was, before the war had begun, you might say, I was opposing the idea of a war in Vietnam, just as I feel it's happening all over again with Colombia, you know. I mean, the war hasn't really begun yet, but it's coming down the road unless we do something powerful to stop it. And I did two books about Vietnam. The second one was called The War Conspiracy, and it contained a chapter about the role of drug networks and their connection to the CIA as a factor in how we got involved in Vietnam. The full title of that book was The War Conspiracy, The Secret Road to the Second Indochina War. So that got me launched on the question of drugs. And of course, then you see things happening over and over again. I mean, that book came out 7 years before we started backing heroin trafficking guerrillas in Afghanistan. But that was the same story again, and it produced another heroin epidemic in this country. And then I started writing about the Contras. I did actually two books that were about the Contras, a book called The Iran-Contra Connection. Had a lot to say about drugs. And, of course, with the Contra Connection, we got a cocaine epidemic. But our presence in Colombia, I think, which is nominally a war on drugs, will, I predict, increase rather than decrease the flow of drugs from that country into this one.
Mm-hmm. Well, there we have a lot of things to pursue here, because you're saying things that, of course, I've heard you say, and I know about Gary Webb, who was working for the San Jose Mercury News and exposing some of these things most recently and got definitely blacklisted. Maybe you want to say something about him right now. I don't quite know what order to do things in, because I know something about it, but I realize that most people will be very shocked to hear about the CIA and the government bringing in the drugs into the United States.
Yes, I never say that the CIA brings in the drugs. What I say is that the CIA sets up relationships, connections, contacts, the result of which is that other people find it much easier to bring drugs into this country. And another byproduct of it is that because these people are now doing things for the CIA in Central America, creating death squads or whatever, if they actually get arrested for drug trafficking, they are usually not prosecuted in court. And if they are prosecuted in court, they're usually let off with a nominal sentence. And even if they're sentenced, then we have the CIA, a famous case, General Bueso Rosa from Honduras, who had been a very big part of the Contra support effort in Honduras, which was the main country where the Contras were.
Maybe we should say who the Contras are, since that's not something we hear about every day in the news anymore, and some listeners might not remember.
Back in the 1980s, you had a revolution in Nicaragua. It put in a Sandinista government, which was definitely way left of center. It was not communist, as people in this country wanted to say it was, but it was a left-wing government. And almost coincidentally, the Reagan administration was elected in 1980 and began a vigorous campaign to oust that government, including the, first of all, the direct indirect assistance to right-wing, I think it's hard to know whether to call them death squads or terrorists. What they were mostly good at was things like killing school teachers and so on. They even killed an American aid worker who was putting in electric power in a village. They killed him. Originally, these people were being managed and run by the Argentine government with financial assistance and encouragement from the CIA. And the Argentines, they've done this all over the continent. They finance their covert operations by simultaneously dealing in the drug traffic and making contacts with drug traffickers. So I think the Reagan administration knew that when they arranged with the Argentines to run this thing. And then when we had the Falkland War and America, after a certain amount of internal uncertainty, sided with Britain rather than with Argentina in the Falkland Islands War, or the War of the Malvinas, as they say in Latin America, after that, relations cooled between the CIA and the Argentines, and so the CIA moved in itself. It had support also from Israel, support from Taiwan, but it became now essentially a CIA operation until finally Congress passed a budget amendment that said that CIA could not finance them. And at that point, the Reagan administration got very tricky and handed it over to Oliver North, working out of the executive office building of the White House. And that's what eventually people were convicted for, because they were breaking clear laws passed by Congress. All through that whole period, which coincided with the Afghan operation, by the way, you had us working with Afghan guerrillas in Afghanistan they had their own heroin refineries. They were very directly involved in the heroin trade. And a great deal of that heroin ended up in the United States. The Contras were a much more disorganized group of people, but the people backing them were also, some of them, very major drug traffickers. And this was, the result was a cocaine epidemic in this country, because not just Bueso Rosa, but a number of people were not touched by the government. We can't just blame the CIA here. It was the Justice Department who wasn't going after these people. We have to blame the whole U.S. government. The Pentagon was involved. The DEA, the Drug Enforcement Administration, it was part of it too. I mean, I can name a number of names of people where the U.S. government knew that these people were trafficking, and in some cases that they were major traffickers, class one traffickers, as we call them. but they weren't touched as long as you had a Contra support operation going on. And very dramatically, in March of 1988, Congress twice voted to end this. And it was clear that this was it. There was going to be no, and you had a number of people in the Reagan administration were now indicted. You know, I mean, it was the end for the Contras. And very dramatically, within a couple of weeks of the second vote against the Contras in Congress, the U.S. government finally did something that should have happened years earlier, moved against another major trafficker in Honduras, a man called Juan Ramon Mata Ballesteros. The DEA had said that he was the major figure in a combine that was responsible for maybe a third, maybe a half of the cocaine coming into the United States. And by 1985, they also knew that he had kidnapped a DEA, or been part of a conspiracy to kidnap a DEA agent in Mexico, Kiki Camarena, a very famous case. It was major headlines in this country. And they knew that he was one of the people behind the kidnapping. Camarena was tortured and murdered. An outrageous case from the point of view of the DEA, but they weren't able to go after Mata, the man responsible, until Congress had voted against the Contras, and then in 2 weeks they picked him up and almost kidnapped him, really. They rushed him from Honduras to the United States and tried him three or four times, put him in jail for kidnapping Camarena.
I remember I saw a film some years ago, and there was testimony, at least he was being interviewed, somebody who worked for the DEA, who's pretty famous, you probably know his name. But I was just couldn't believe what I was hearing. He was saying, yeah, we found this drug trafficker, we did all this great investigation in this work, and we found him, and they wouldn't let us arrest him.
Right.
And I saw this on film, you know, which made it particularly convincing. The guy who was stopped and who was exposing all this, the DEA agent himself, was saying it.
I wonder if you're talking about a film I was in myself. There was a DEA agent by the name of Dennis Dale, very high level. He had actually worked in the Middle East, so, I mean, this is another side of the picture. And he targeted, it was his job to only go after Class 1 traffickers, the very top, the big guns, the kingpins, as we call them sometimes. And he said what was frustrating about his work was that he said it this way: every single time they targeted a major trafficker, he turned out to be an asset of the CIA. And what he didn't say, but clearly what he meant, was then he wasn't allowed to get the man arrested, because CIA requirements took precedence over the policy of keeping drugs out of America. It was true with Mata also. There was a DEA office in Honduras, and by 1983, they knew that Mata was a drug trafficker. They knew that his airline, Setco, was part of a combine of airlines that were bringing drugs into the United States. But at the same time, the CIA made a contract with Mata and Setco. Well, they made it with Setco. Setco became the major airline supplying the Contras. And this was rather embarrassing that the DEA were moving against Setco. Suddenly, in the middle of 1983, the Reagan administration Vice President Bush made the announcement that there would henceforward be a joint collaboration between CIA and DEA. They would work together. And almost the first thing that happened within a couple of weeks is they closed down the DEA office in Honduras, even though that was one of the major, probably of all the little countries in Latin America, in Central America, not counting Mexico, of those small Central American countries. Most of the cocaine was coming in through Honduras, and yet that's the country where they chose to close down the DEA office. And a number of U.S. officials have said that they didn't want to embarrass the Contra support operation.
So the guns were going to the Contras and the cocaine was coming back in the planes?
Yes, that roughly speaking you can say that. Often it was a kind of triangular thing that a plane would be cleared for special flights in and out of an airport, a military airport even, in the United States. And there was a big also airport in El Salvador called Ilopango, so that they didn't, often what happened was a big plane, a C-130 or something like that, would take arms to Ilopango, and then sometimes the same plane or sometimes a smaller plane would move them into Costa Rica. Most of these arms went to the Contras in Costa Rica because it was much easier in Honduras. Costa Rica wasn't as friendly to the Contras as the Honduran army was, and the Honduran army was running Honduras. And then the plane would go on, say, to Barranquilla in Colombia or some big airstrip in Colombia and load the cocaine there and come back to the States. Of the particular flights we've been able to target, there were small planes that would go directly to an airstrip in Costa Rica and then come back with cocaine because there were processing plants in Costa Rica. And often the press, when they finally admitted there was a problem, they talked about it as if that was the problem, these little planes that were going to Costa Rica and back. And then sometimes they would editorialize and say, of course, that those little planes couldn't account for the huge flood of cocaine coming into the country. But that's forgetting about the big planes that went to Ilopango. And these were military transports, the kind that they used in Vietnam, C-123s, C-130s. 5 or 6 times the load of these small Cessnas and so on, aero commanders that were flying into Costa Rica.
Well, Peter Dale Scott, I'm surprised you're still alive to talk about this. It's such astounding stuff, and as I say, I know what I've heard it before, but even as I'm hearing you right this minute, I think, well, probably, you know, many listeners, probably some people believe it, but many listeners are saying, oh, no, that can't possibly be true. I am surprised. You know, we're sitting in your beautiful house here in Berkeley, yeah, talking about this, and of course, most people don't know this. And you've written books written this book, Cocaine Politics, Drugs, Armies, and the CIA in Central America. We have the updated edition here of a couple of years ago, and you wrote this book about 10 years ago. So it's available. You wrote it with Jonathan Marshall. And why is it that people don't know about it? And that you know that you are still alive.
Well, let me say I don't regard myself as... Some people have been very courageous in this matter. I don't see myself in their company. The courageous people are the people who broke the story, who went and did the research on the ground and came back.
And you did this research. Most of it was papers, and it was done in the United States.
What I did was mostly documentary, and in this particular book, Cocaine Politics, we are interpreting and presenting to the public a lot of material that was gathered by a subcommittee of the Senate, Senator Kerry's subcommittee on drugs and terrorism. You know, I went to Washington in the middle of the Iran-Contra crisis. I worked for a think tank in Washington. My job actually was to collect material and offer it to various congressional committees and subcommittees, including the Kerry Committee. And I do have to say that a number of people in Washington were very frightened at that time. They were frightened for their lives. And I knew reporters. One reporter who was one of the people who broke the story, he found he was under 24-hour surveillance. And he knew people in the Washington police. This is right in the city of Washington. So he went to a detective that he knew on the Washington police force. And the detective came back and said, I have bad news for you. He said, we're not responsible for the surveillance, and we can't find out who is. We don't know if it's the mob or if it's the if it's a government or a foreign government. We just can't get a trace on it. So that gives you an indication of the high forces that were at work at that time. Senator Kerry himself set up this subcommittee, and a lot of people said he was risking his political career, and almost immediately he was hauled before the Ethics Committee of the Senate in connection with having done this. And luckily they cleared him. The difference between then and now is that you had a Democratic majority in Congress at this period, and you had a Republican president. Now it's the other way around, and there isn't the same kind of congressional... the Republicans who control Congress now are not as likely to go ferreting for the truth about the drug business as Senator Kerry was in the 1980s.
Mm-hmm. Well, the corruption runs deep here. I guess that's what you call it.
Yes, well, you know, let's talk about corruption. It's clear, perfectly obvious and admitted by everyone that the drug lords, being some of the wealthiest people in Latin America, protect themselves by giving money to political candidates. And this is one of the complaints about Colombia. You know, the great case for going into Colombia is that they have there now what they call narco guerrillas, meaning that the guerrillas are taxing the drug trade and they're using profits from drug trafficking, not that they traffic themselves, but that they take a percentage of the drug profits. Well, if you're going to talk that way, you would have to say there's a narco government because the government is also taxing the drug traffickers. You would have to say that maybe not the present president Pastrana, but certainly the preceding president, Samper, it was common knowledge and virtually admitted that he had received a large payoff from the drug traffickers. So you had a narco president, but you have a narco Congress. So many of the members of the Congress there were elected with the aid of money from Congress. And the poor judges, and I really feel sympathy for the judges in Colombia, they say they have the choice between oro y piombo, between a payoff or a bullet. The honest ones get killed, and the dishonest ones, they have done a lot to clean up the judiciary in the last 10 years, but talk about courage. It really takes courage to oppose the drug trade down there. But I think we should look at Colombia and say, well, if all that can happen in a country like Colombia, could it happen in a country like the United States? And all I can say is that there are major traffickers like Leonel Martinez in Florida who gave generously to candidates in this country, to George Bush Sr. and Jeb Bush, his son, in Florida. And it's again striking that Leonel Martinez is one of these people who was known to be drug trafficking, but only got arrested after the Contra support effort, which he was part of, was wound up. He wasn't indicted, I think, until 1989, although he had been trafficking for 4 or 5 years before that.
Mm-hmm. Well, and of course, in the United States, we don't often... people often talk about corruption in other countries, like you were just talking about Colombia, and they're so shocked, and they think it's so different here. But
it's hard to turn the lens around and look in the opposite direction. I'm not trying to suggest that drug lords control this country the way they can control a banana republic or Colombia, where they are among the richest people. But this is, I think, a neglected factor in the problem of, why do we have this problem? We have this problem because our country allies itself with the rich around the world against the poor. And in many parts of the world, the rich are the drug traffickers. The easiest way to make a big fortune, I mean, there are other ways in Colombia, but we're protecting landowners now against peasants in Colombia. That's what a good deal of this war that we're about to fight is going to be. Well, since early 1980s, the biggest group of people buying land have been the drug traffickers. That's one of the main things they've done with their money. So we are, in effect, allying ourselves with a corrupt class and a corrupt government. If you want to say that the guerrillas are corrupt too, I don't mind. But the big money, the big drug money, is on the side of the right wing, which we're allying ourselves with, and particularly the army, which has had a long history of protecting drug traffickers, protecting drug fields, and working with drug traffickers to create death squads that go out and kill not just leftists, but even human rights workers.
Yeah. Well, and of course, it's not only there, it's here. I mean, well, that's what you're saying. I just want to kind of underline it, I guess, that
yes.
It's our tax money that's being used to do this.
Well, I like to keep the focus on Colombia because I feel the way I felt back in 1961 about Vietnam. I mean, most people at this point wouldn't believe that America could commit another Vietnam War all over again. But, you know, a lot of the things that Ollie North did, which is to secretly finance private armies to go and do the fighting for us, that's become the U.S. style now. We have two big private military corporations, DynCorp and MPRI, Military Professional Resources, Inc. They have big contracts in Colombia. They're doing most of the fighting. They're taking most of the casualties. There have already been U.S. casualties in Colombia. But it's like Vietnam. You know, it was very small at the beginning, but at a certain point, we're going to realize that what we're doing isn't working, and then the question is, do we get out or do we stay in? And a lot of people are going to say that U.S. prestige is at stake, when what they really mean is that the prestige of their own foolish bureaucracy is at stake. All I can say is it would be much easier to stop that war now than it will be 4 or 5 years down the line.
Well, we're really about out of time, but I got to ask you, who pays these private armies?
Well, they have contracts with the Defense Department or the CIA or both. And they are ex-military and ex-CIA. So it's almost like a career promotion. You work in the CIA and then you retire and you go to work at a much bigger salary for these private groups. And you're a bit more at risk, I guess, in Colombia, but it's big money.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's so much more to talk about, Peter Dale Scott. I hope we can talk again soon, and I want to urge people to get your book, Cocaine Politics, Drugs, Armies, and the CIA in Central America, written by Peter Dale Scott and Jonathan Marshall, and put out by the University of California Press. So thank you very, very much, Peter Dale Scott.
Thank you.
And my name's Sue Supriano. Thanks for listening. Website where you can learn more is http://Socrates, S-O-C-R-A-T-E-S dot Berkeley, B-E-R-K-E-L-E-Y dot E-D-U, /tilde, little wiggly line, P-D-S-C-O-T-T. That's Socrates.berkeley.edu/tilde P-D-Scott.